center, where he would have either drowned or been boiled alive. But his predicament was still extremely hazardous, seemingly alone in the lethal wilderness of ocean. The weight of his clothes, boots, and the Sig Sauer on his hip were all uniting to try to drag him down. The first priority for Ryan was to try to establish his bearings. He had drifted a little farther from the danger zone, with the water around him only a few degrees above blood heat. Timing his effort, he swam into the next rolling wave, seizing the moment to try to look around him. But the acidic filth in the sea hurt his good eye as he blinked it open, making it impossible to make out anything beyond a vertiginous blur. Ryan rubbed at his eye with his fingers, repeating the maneuver with the next roller, struggling to hold himself at its apogee long enough to see what was going on. It was partly successful, but still intensely dispiriting for him. The gigantic pillar of debris and steam had blotted out everything in one direction, concealing a full quarter of the Atlantic from his gaze. The rest of the horizon offered no hope at all. It wasn't possible to see any clear distance because of the force and height of the waves. At that first glimpse, Ryan could see no sight of the Keys, but he knew that the strip of beach couldn't be that far off. His last visual memory before going over the side of the boat had been of the land to the left, no more than 600 or 700 yards away. But in what direction? Another particularly large comber came toward him, lifting him with immeasurable power, carrying him higher than before, allowing him a better view of his drowning world. Ryan had seen enough this time to allow him a total awareness of what faced him. At the edges of the boiling eruption, he had glimpsed a boat. It was a full half mile away from him, just a tiny speck of light against the darkness of the biblical catastrophe. It was difficult to judge, but it looked to Ryan as if the boat were heading away from him, back to safety. In his heart, he couldn't blame them. After he'd gone over, the chances of his surviving would have seemed a deal less than 1,000,000 to 1 against, and he would now be an invisible speck in the vastness, effectively out of any hope of being spotted. To his friends, Ryan had no doubt at all that he would be stone dead. If that was the blackest side, there was also a glimmering of light, of hope. He had seen land, an indistinct strip of whiteness off behind him. The sight snatched away again as he plunged into the valley between the rolling waves. Distance was difficult to gauge, but it looked like his memory of around the half-mile mark was close enough. All he had to do now was swim to safety. It was hard, grimingly tough, plowing stubbornly through the Atlantic, out of sight of his destination for most of the time. There were several occasions when Ryan realized he was swimming slightly off course, angling away from the enticing beach, fooled by the swirling currents and the tumbling swell. 3 or 4 times he trod water, trying to look behind him, in case the miracle had happened and the boat was, after all, coming to search for him. But now, they were out of sight. The other thing that Ryan looked for was some marine life, with the profound hope that he saw nothing. Michael's experience with the Mutie snake, and his own, some time ago, with a great white, had put him off aquatic encounters for life. If anything could enable Ryan to reach the shore quicker, it would have been a dark fin cutting through the water in his general direction. The last few minutes were the longest. The waves were gentler, helping to roll Ryan toward the gently sloping beach, but he was getting close to exhaustion. As he allowed his feet to trail, the boots feeling like leaden weights, Ryan finally touched bottom, swimming a few more ponderous strokes until he could stand waist deep. Even then, he still stumbled and fell twice, clambering onto the soft, sloping, sandy beach. Once he was clear of the water, he sat down, taking the chance to look all around. Out at sea, the smoke and steam had almost vanished. There was no boat to be seen. Behind him were palms, and behind that, he guessed there would be the remains of the ancient highway. The one thing he didn't know was how far up the coast the current had carried him. But for now, all he could do was lie down and rest. Ryan blinked and opened his eye. Blazing down from a pink-tinged sky, the dark clouds of the storm that had blown up during the undersea eruption had drifted away. Ryan had an acute sense of time and figured that he'd been crashed out for around 90 minutes. His body ached and the skin across his forehead felt tender and tight. His clothes had begun to dry on him. The panga was still on one hip, the blaster on the other. The Atlantic stretched out to the east as far as he could see, untouched and untroubled, and totally devoid of any sort of life. Ryan stood, wincing at the pains that lanced through his thighs and shoulders. There was still a squidging wetness in his socks, and his mane of black hair was damp at his nape. The Institute lay to the south, to his right as he faced the sea. Far off to the north was the mainland of old Florida. The best guess that Ryan could muster put him about 5 or 6 miles from home.
First things first, gotta strike inland and find out if the old Highway 1 is still there.
His right hand stung, and he saw that he'd scratched it on some coral while fumbling ashore. A narrow thread of blood oozed from it, and as a precaution, Ryan sucked hard at it, spitting crimson into the white sand. He plodded through the ubiquitous palms, past a line of dried brush, and came to what might once have been a picnic area. The rotted remains of benches and tables stood gaunt on the cracked concrete. A square building, its roof long fallen, still showed faded signs that read Men and Women. Ryan walked to the structure to look at a metal-framed board, which he guessed had probably once held a detailed map for travelers. Now there was only a small section of colored paper inside the broken glass. Less than 3 inches long by 1 inch high, it held the runic message, "You are here." The four-lane highway was only a few yards inland from the rest area. The median divider had rusted through and been distorted by earth movements into a corrugated ribbon. The actual pavement was also badly scarred and furrowed, showing breaks and long gaps. Something moved in among some stunted bushes on the far side of the blacktop, and Ryan reached for the butt of the 6-hour, but the rustling ceased. As he started walking south, he saw a tumbled road sign, but someone had used it to daub graffiti in yellow paint. The simplicity of bigotry was all it said. It had been tagged with capital letters, BB. Ryan read it twice, then shook his head and carried on. Ahead of him was the ruin of what had once been a tourist eatery. The idea of vacations and tourism was something that had always fascinated Ryan, and he had relished several talks with Christie about the concept. That someone would work for a whole year until their backs broke or their brains fried, so that they could go somewhere different just for a couple of weeks and lie on a beach or climb a mountain or ride a white-knuckle fun fair, seemed the height of madness to Ryan.
Why didn't we do what they wanted more often?
The work ethos. That's what Peter Morita used to quote when I was a little girl. He used to tell me that work was a blessing to the soul and character of the person who did the working. How it bred diligence and self-respect. Said a man without work wasn't a man at all.
The idea was so ridiculous that it used to break them both up. In Deathlands, it was very fundamental. You worked and you got to eat. Unless you happened to be a powerful baron, in which case you persuaded others to work for you, so that you got to eat. That was all there was. Work equaled food. You got the food so you could keep working until you needed to eat again. Ryan stood a few paces off from the tumble-down building and stared at it. There were plenty of regions in Deathlands where you'd step triple careful around old places, but the keys seemed to be almost devoid of human life. If you didn't count the occasional murderous Indian. The sign along the front had been sealed in clear plastic and had survived nearly 100 years of storms. It wasn't easy to read, but it was possible. Mom's Place was the name. Oddly, Ryan had eaten in a dozen eateries called Mom's Place, and they had been universally terrible. He wondered whether this one might have been any different before Skydark. One window was unbroken and carried the symbol of Coca-Cola on it. Ryan knew that that had been the beverage that everyone drank back then. He'd only ever sampled it once. The trader had found a case hidden in the corner of a cellar of an isolated house near the Villa of Crested Butte. The crews of both war wags had gathered around for a ceremonial opening and tasting. Most of them had liked it, though one or two had thought that it was too fizzy for them to really enjoy. Ryan glanced around, and then pushed open the front door. What remained of the front door? The bottom half had been kicked in, and the top part was broken, hanging crookedly by a squeaking hinge. It was slightly cooler inside, with that flat, damp smell of all long empty buildings. Ryan wondered why it was that they all seemed to carry the faint scent of stale urine. There was a three-legged chair propped up in one corner, and two tables in a flowered formica pattern. A mark on the floor showed where a counter had stood alongside a hole in the wall that probably led through to the kitchen. A board was nailed to the wall opposite the entrance.